Good morning, good evening, or good night, whichever time I find you. And welcome back, legends, or welcome new listeners to Stories, Fables, Ghostly Tales, and I'm your host, The Tale Teller. And today, I have for you a treat, something different for Christmas. I have an episode dedicated to the topic of inventors being killed by their inventions. Oh, yes. And boy, oh, are there many. And a lot of them have that same trend going, but I'm getting ahead of myself. A big shout out to a brand new Earl Grey enforcer I'm lucky to have, Dave Baxter, you superstar. Thank you so much for supporting me. And on that note, if you too want to become a supporter in any tier, you can visit my Patreon page at www.patreon.com/SFGT, where you get episodes early and higher quality audio. Now, we have five inventors to get through today. We have Franz Reichelt and the Flying Coat, Thomas Midgley Jr., the Double Whammy inventor, the pioneer of radioactivity, Marie Curie, which I'm sure a lot of you will know, Henry Smolinski and the Flying Pinto, and lastly, William Bullock and the Printing Press of Doom. And boy, oh, is that a gruesome one. So, strap yourselves in, turn the lights off, turn the sound up, and pour yourself a delicious cup of tea. Because we're going to dive in head first when it comes to each inventor and their stories. Enjoy, you legends. Inventor number one, Franz Reichelt and the Flying Coat. It's 1912 in Paris. The Eiffel Tower, already the pride of the city, stands tall as an emblem of human ingenuity. Enter Franz Reichelt, an Austro-Hungarian-born French tailor and inventor with a vision. A vision of saving lives with his revolutionary wearable parachute. The kind of idea that, if successful, could have made him the hero of aviation safety. But alas, as we now know, Franz didn't exactly stick the landing. The man behind the parachute. Franz Reichelt wasn't your typical daredevil. He was a tailor by trade, a man of fabric, thread, and creativity. Born in Austria, but living in Paris, he spent his days designing and crafting clothing. But like many of history's inventors, he had a restless mind and an ambition that reached far beyond the confines of his sewing studio. In the early 1900s, aviation was all the rage. Planes were taking to the skies, and with this newfound freedom came a terrifying new reality: plane crashes. Franz saw an opportunity to change the course of history by creating a device that could allow pilots to safely escape mid-air disasters. His idea? Well, a parachute that wasn't bulky or awkward, but wearable, like an elegant overcoat. He was inspired by the work of André-Jacques Gunnerin, who developed and successfully tested the first frameless parachute design. His parachute coat was made of layers of fabric and rubber, designed to open and catch the air when deployed. In theory, it was brilliant. In practice, well, we'll get to that. Early tests, the warning signs. Before his infamous leap, Franz tested his parachute design using dummies. He dropped them from the fifth floor of his apartment building in Paris. These initial tests were promising, but he ran into difficulty when he tried to create a wearable suit out of the design. His focus was on reducing weight while increasing surface area for the canopy. Despite his efforts, the dummies often plummeted to the ground, indicating significant flaws in the design. Most people might have taken this as a sign to go back to the drawing board, but not Franz, no. He doubled down. He believed the problem wasn't with the design, but with the weight and dynamics of the dummies. According to Franz, a human being with their agility and natural ability to control their descent would make the coat function perfectly. This, my friends, is what we call optimism. The fateful day, February 4th, 1912, was a chilly winter morning in Paris. Franz had secured permission from authorities to test his invention at the Eiffel Tower, under the pretense of using a dummy, not himself. It was a prime location, 57 meters, about 187 feet, up from the first platform, giving plenty of time for the parachute to deploy. Crowds gathered to watch, including journalists and photographers. Many of them assumed Franz would be using a dummy for the test. Imagine their shock when Franz himself emerged, dressed in his parachute coat, ready to jump himself. Let's pause here for a moment. Franz Reichelt was not a professional aviator, nor a stuntman, nor an athlete. He was a tailor. His decision to personally test his invention was equal parts bravery and definitely foolhardy, though hindsight suggests it leaned more towards the latter. The jump. Around 8 a.m. after some delays, Franz climbed over the guardrail of the Eiffel Tower's first platform. Onlookers begged him to reconsider. Friends had reportedly tried to talk him out of it for weeks, but Franz was determined. He believed in his invention. He stood there for about 40 seconds, adjusting his coat, before leaping into the air. For a brief second, the world held its breath. I know I would have. Would it work? Could this tailor-turned-inventor defy the odds and prove everyone wrong? Nope. No, he could not. His parachute never fully opened. It seemed to wrap and tangle around him, and Franz plummeted straight to the ground. Witnesses later described the sound of his impact as horrifying. I mean, that's one way to put it. The fall killed him instantly. Well, that is some reprieve. I can't imagine wanting to survive after that kind of fall. The aftermath. Franz's tragic leap was widely reported in newspapers around the world. Photos of his jump and the aftermath were plastered across headlines, making him infamous overnight. He became a cautionary tale for inventors, a symbol of what happens when ambition outpaces practicality. The irony, of course, is that Franz's invention wasn't entirely without merit. Decades later, wearable parachutes became a reality, but they were developed with the help of advanced materials, rigorous testing, and most importantly, crash test dummies, instead of the inventors themselves. Let's find out what actually went wrong. Why didn't the parachute work? Design flaws. The main issue was that the parachute never fully opened and seemed to wrap and tangle around him. Rather than providing the necessary drag to slow his fall, parachutes need to create significant drag, and Franz's design simply didn't achieve that. Insufficient testing. Franz's belief that a human being could correct the flaws that plagued his dummy tests was overly optimistic. I'm not sure what powers humans have to control their descent, but there you go. Controlled incremental testing is the hallmark of successful invention, and Franz skipped a few steps. Franz's determination was admirable, but it blinded him to obvious red flags. His confidence in his own ability led him to ignore critical feedback and evidence. But he does have a legacy. Today, Franz Reichelt is remembered both as a pioneer in the early days of parachuting and as a tragic example of hubris. His story is both inspiring and cautionary, a reminder of the fine line between brilliance and disaster. Interestingly, his leap from the Eiffel Tower has been immortalized in history books, documentaries, and even comedic sketches, perhaps in poor taste. While his inventions didn't succeed, Franz's daring spirit is a testament to the lengths inventors will go in the pursuit of progress. So what can we learn from Franz Reichelt? Well, maybe don't jump off buildings unless you're absolutely sure your parachute works, and perhaps, just maybe, let the dummies take the first fall. There's also a side note here where it's been reported that Franz had a heart attack before or during the event. But this is strictly taken from Wikipedia. A writing in the summer supplement of Liberation in 2009 mentioned that an autopsy concluded that Reichelt had died of a heart attack during his fall. But there's no sort of reference that I could find to support this evidence. I'm not sure why that's even there. But I mean, falling and plummeting at that rate and being met with a huge surprise upon being tangled by your own clothes, I can understand why that could be the case. And having a heart attack during the fall, met with that reality, is surely plausible. Let's look at our next inventor, number two, Thomas Midgley Jr., the double whammy inventor. The early triumphs of a chemical pioneer. Thomas Midgley Jr., which is a tongue twister, was a brilliant inventor and chemist whose work left an indelible mark on the 20th century. Unfortunately, it wasn't the kind of mark anyone wants to leave. Born on May 18th, 1889, Midgley had a knack for tackling big challenges, particularly in the realm of industrial chemistry. His career flourished as he developed groundbreaking technologies, but his legacy is a cautionary tale about the unintended consequences of innovation. Midgley's first major success? Leaded gasoline. Midgley's first major success came in the 1920s when he developed tetraethyl lead, TEL, as an additive to gasoline. At the time, cars were becoming more common, but their engines suffered from knocking, a problem caused by uneven fuel combustion. I'm sure you've heard old cars doing the old putt-putt-putt, and that's what knocking is. Midgley discovered that adding TEL, tetraethyl, to gasoline could reduce knocking, resulting in smoother engine performance. Automakers celebrated his discovery, and TEL, or TEL, became a staple of the automotive industry. What no one considered, or perhaps ignored, was the devastating impact this leaded fuel would have on public health and the environment. Lead poisoning soon became a widespread issue, affecting millions and causing severe neurological damage, particularly in children. Despite early warnings from the US Public Health Service in 1922, the dangers were largely ignored until decades later. The global phase-out of leaded gasoline began in the 1970s, but the damage had already been done. Midgley's next big idea, CFCs. Not content with solving just one problem, Midgley turned his attention to refrigeration. In the 1930s, refrigerants like ammonia and sulfur dioxide were effective but highly toxic and corrosive. Nasty stuff. Midgley developed chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, a new class of refrigerants that were stable, non-toxic, and easy to use. He demonstrated their safety by inhaling freon vapors and extinguishing a candle with his breath in a famous presentation. CFCs were a massive success and quickly became the industry standard, not just for refrigeration, but also for aerosol sprays and air conditioning. What no one realized at the time was that these seemingly harmless chemicals were wreaking havoc on the Earth's ozone layer. By the 1980s, scientists discovered that CFCs were creating a massive hole in the ozone, exposing the planet to harmful ultraviolet radiation. This revelation led to global bans on CFCs, but the environmental toll lingers to this day. Good God, Midgley, an innovator, but also a pioneer of problems. Let's invent a new way to ruin things. Poor guy. I cannot blame him, though, for at least trying to innovate. Ironically, the man who had unwittingly caused global-scale disasters and terrible, terrible neurological damage to multiple generations also faced a more immediate personal tragedy. In 1940, Midgley contracted polio, which left him partially paralyzed. Being the inventive spirit he was, he decided to engineer a solution to his physical limitations. Oh my goodness, I have no idea where this is going, but it cannot be good. Midgley designed a complex system of ropes, oh no, and pulleys that allowed him to lift himself out of bed. Okay, sounds theoretically good, ladies and gentlemen, but let's read further. However, oh God, it is often reported that he was accidentally killed by his own invention, but his death was declared by the coroner to be a suicide. On November the 2nd, 1944, Midgley was found strangled to death by the device he had devised to help him get out of bed unassisted. But why the suicide? Some speculated that it was Midgley's guilt on the CFCs and also the neurological damage via the lead that led him to use his own device to end his own life. The legacy of consequences. Thomas Midgley's junior story is a stark reminder of the double-edged sword of innovation. His contributions to science and industry solved pressing problems of his time, but created new ones of staggering proportions. Leaded gasoline and CFCs remain two of the most infamous examples of technologies that outlived their usefulness, leaving a trail of environmental and health disasters. Midgley's death, eerily caused by his own ingenuity, feels like a metaphor for his entire career. a brilliant mind undone by the very forces he set in motion. His life serves as a cautionary tale as well for inventors and scientists everywhere. Progress, no matter how ingenious, must be tempered with foresight and responsibility. Now let's move on to inventor 3. Marie Curie, the pioneer of radioactivity. Born, and I'm going to ruin this name, Maria Sklodowska in 1867, was a scientific trailblazer whose groundbreaking work shaped modern physics and chemistry. As the first woman to win a Nobel Prize and the only person to win Nobel Prizes in two different sciences, Curie's name is synonymous with brilliance and perseverance. However, her pioneering discoveries came at a deadly cost. Marie, along with her husband, Pierre, isolated two new elements, polonium, named after her homeland of Poland, and not the processed meat, polony, and radium, which became the cornerstone of her legacy. Her research on radioactivity, a term she coined, was revolutionary. At the time, little was known about the nature of atomic particles, and her work opened the door to a new understanding of energy and matter. But as often happens with breakthroughs, the risk of her discoveries weren't fully understood. Radium, in particular, was a mysterious and captivating element, glowing with an otherworldly light that fascinated both scientists and the public. Unfortunately, its dangers were underestimated or outright ignored in favor of its novelty. Radium, the miracle and the menace. In the early 1900s, radium was heralded as a miracle substance. Its radiant glow made it a popular novelty item, and it was marketed for an astonishing range of uses. Entrepreneurs infused radium into everything from toothpaste and face cream to health tonics and even children's toys. It was believed to have rejuvenating and healing properties, despite growing evidence to the contrary. Can you imagine giving old Timmy a wonderful toy and noticing how his skin is peeling on his hands? No, it can't be the toy. No, definitely not. It must be the excessive orange juice he's eating. Poor Timmy. Curie herself worked tirelessly with radium, often handling it without any protective equipment. She would carry vials of radium in her pocket, store samples in her laboratory, and marvel at its glow during late-night experiments. This was a common practice at the time, as the dangers of radiation were not yet well understood. The slow toll of radiation exposure. Curie's dedication to science came at a high cost. Years of unprotected exposure to radioactive materials began to take a toll on her health. She suffered from chronic health issues, including double cataracts, which required 4 operations to restore her eyesight, and other symptoms that were later understood to be caused by radiation poisoning. Despite these ailments, she continued her work, driven by an unshakable passion for discovery. I see a general trend in our inventors. Her death in 1934 from aplastic anemia, a condition linked to a prolonged radiation exposure, go figure, was a heartbreaking end to a life dedicated to science. At the time, her illness was not fully understood, as the long-term effects of radiation exposure were still being studied. Today, her notebooks and personal items are so highly radioactive that they are stored in lead-lined boxes and can only be handled with protective equipment. Holy smokes! Now that's what you call a legacy. And Marie Curie's legacy was a double-edged sword. She is both inspiring but also a cautionary tale as well. She opened the door to the fields of nuclear physics and radiotherapy, pioneering treatments for cancer that have saved countless lives. Yet her own life was claimed by the very elements she discovered. Her story is a stark reminder of the thin line between scientific progress and personal sacrifice. Curie's impact on the world is undeniable, but her tragic end underscores the importance of safety and foresight in scientific research. Her work changed the course of history, but also serves as a lesson: the pursuit of knowledge must always be balanced with an understanding of its risks. Today, Curie is remembered not only for her unparalleled contributions to science, but also as a symbol of resilience and dedication. Her discoveries illuminated the hidden forces of the universe, forces as deadly as they are transformative. The glow that captivated her imagination became her undoing, a tragic irony that makes her story more remarkable and deeply human. And I can understand. Working with this substance that glows in the dark, that ominous, eerie attraction, without realizing till it's too late, and the damage already done. I can totally understand Curie just doubling down and doing as much as she possibly could from a scientific perspective, knowing full well the ramifications. What an absolute stalwart and dedicated scientist. Hats off for her amazing sacrifice. Our next inventor, number 4, Henry Smolinski and the Flying Pinto. Cultural and textual context. The 1970s were a time of rapid technological advancement and cultural optimism about the future. In the post-Apollo era, people believed the sky was no longer the limit, and visions of flying cars were at the forefront of speculative fiction. I think you can see where this is going. Popular shows like The Jetsons and a growing fascination with space-age technology fueled public interest in such groundbreaking innovations. Henry Smolinski tapped into the zeitgeist with the Ave Miser, if I'm saying that correctly. The promise of a flying car wasn't just about convenience, it symbolized freedom, individuality, and the ability to transcend traditional constraints. Smolinski's concept of attaching an airplane to a car seemed like a logical and achievable step towards making this dream a reality. I mean, Smolinski was basically the early days MacGyver. By leveraging existing technologies, a Ford Pinto and a Cessna Skymaster, he sought to make flying cars accessible and practical for everyday consumers. But here's the Pinto problem. The choice of the Ford Pinto as a car component added an ironic twist to the story. The Pinto was already infamous for safety issues, particularly its tendency to explode in rear-end collisions due to poorly placed fuel tanks. Choosing such a controversial vehicle as the foundation for a flying car may have been a cost-saving decision, but it also highlighted a disregard for its notorious safety record. This decision foreshadowed the catastrophic failure that would later define the Miser's story. I can really see another trend here when it comes to inventors. Basically being like, you know what, this is a great idea. I'm going to combine A with B and I just hope it works. Don't mind the horribly bad track record and the fact that the back of this vehicle explodes when tampered with. I think I'll strap this to some plane wings and set it on its way. To the heavens with you, wonderful Pinto. My goodness, Smolinski. Engineering challenges, structural integrity, and weight distribution. The Miser's design was, at its core, a fusion of two distinct engineering systems, automobiles and aviation. While this might sound intuitive, cars and planes share engines, aerodynamics, and propulsion. It presented immense challenges. Aviation designs demand rigorous weight management, as every additional pound affects flight stability, fuel efficiency, and structural integrity. The Pinto, when paired with the rear assembly of the Cessna Skymaster, far exceeds the aircraft's certified gross weight capacity. This made the Miser not only unsafe, but particularly unfit for flight from the start. Worse, the added weight likely compromised the welds and struts attached to the aircraft components and the car, setting the stage for the eventual mechanical failure. Can you imagine the answer to solving this problem? Look, mate, your car plane is essentially glued together by welded steel. How are you going to make it structurally more stable, mate? Well, I think I'll just weld more? Good answer. You know what? Brilliant. I'm backing you 100%. Testing and quality control. Modern aircrafts undergo thousands of hours on testing, both in simulations and real-world conditions, before they are deemed safe for operation. The Ave Miser, however, appears to have skipped many of these critical steps. Am I surprised? No, I am not. While Smolinski did conduct test flights, the fatal flaws in the design, such as weak welds and inadequate weight distribution, suggest a lack of comprehensive testing and engineering oversight. The incident in August 1973, when the right wing strut detached during flight, should have been a wake-up call. Instead of pausing production to address the design flaws, Smolinski pressed on. Driven by ambition and perhaps financial pressures, this decision proved fatal just weeks later. The tragic final flight. A case of human overconfidence. On September the 11th, 1973, Smolinski and his colleague, Harold Blake, undertook a test flight despite the Miser's known structural issues. Now, just to be clear, 1973 really isn't that long ago, really. So it baffles me that this still took place. I'm leaning to financial pressures that caused this decision. This decision, though, reflects a tragic pattern of the scene in pioneering ventures: overconfidence in untested systems. The decision to fly without a professional pilot who might have refused to operate an inherently unsafe aircraft further compounded the risks. Eyewitnesses reported that the right-wing strut detached shortly after takeoff, leading to a loss of control and the catastrophic crash. The deaths of Smolensky and Blake marked the end of the Ave Miser project and underscored the high stakes of experimental engineering. Now, this gives me flashbacks to my Ocean Gate episode. Holy smokes. Simply ignoring safety precautions, leading to the deaths of many. History truly repeats itself. Broader implications and lessons learned for innovators. Smolensky's story is a cautionary tale about the dangers of rushing innovation without sufficient testing and safety protocols. While his vision of a flying car was undeniably ambitious, it also lacked the meticulous planning and attention to detail necessary for success, like proper welding. This lesson is especially relevant today, as industries like autonomous vehicles, drones, and space exploration continue to push technological boundaries. The public's role in technological adoption, though, does have its place. The Miser's failure also highlights the importance of public perception in technological advancement. The flying car wasn't just a technical challenge, it was a cultural phenomenon. For the concept to succeed, it needed to inspire trust and confidence among potential buyers. The crash and subsequent fallout ensured that flying cars would remain a distant dream for decades, tarnished by the memory of Smolensky's tragedy. The aviation and automotive industries operate under stringent safety regulations today, largely because of lessons learned from projects like the Miser. Smolensky's story demonstrates why rigorous oversight is essential in preventing similar tragedies. It's a sobering reminder that cutting corners can have dire consequences, not just for inventors, but for public safety as a whole. It was, though, a bold attempt to merge the worlds of aviation and automotive design. But it does serve as a poignant reminder of the delicate balance between innovation and safety. So while Smolensky's vision didn't come to fruition, it continues to inspire engineers and inventors who strive to make flying cars a reality. Perhaps someday the lessons of the Miser will help pave the way for safer and more successful attempts at bringing this sci-fi dream to life. And our last inventor, number 5, William Bullock and the printing press of doom. The revolutionary inventor. William Bullock was a 19th century inventor whose contributions transformed the printing industry. Born in 1813 in Greenville, New York, Bullock's innovations laid the groundwork for modern mass media by making printing faster, cheaper, and more accessible. He was a self-taught mechanical genius who, like many inventors of his time, sought to solve practical problems with ingenious solutions. His most famous invention by far is the rotary printing press, revolutionizing the way newspapers, books, and other printed material were produced. However, this same invention, celebrated for its efficiency and ingenuity, would ultimately claim Bullock's life in one of history's most tragically ironic twists: the printing revolution. Before Bullock's rotary press, the printing process was slow and labor-intensive. Early presses required operators to manually press paper against a flat, inked plate, limiting the speed and volume of production. Bullock's invention, however, automated much of the process, using continuous rolls of paper that passed through rotary cylinders. This design not only sped up production, but also allowed for double-sided printing. Bullock's press was an improvement over Richard March Hoe's rotary press, which was invented in the 1840s. Bullock's press allowed for continuous large rolls of paper to be automatically fed through the rollers, eliminating the laborious hand-feeding system of earlier presses. The press was self-adjusting, printed on both sides, folded the paper, and the sharp, serrated knife that rarely needed sharpening cut sheets with rapid precision. This sounds like some Iron Man-esque level of technology back then, and even now. With the advent of Bullock's press, newspapers could print thousands of copies in a fraction of the time it previously took, paving the way for the explosion of mass media in the mid-19th century. Publications like the Cincinnati Times and the Philadelphia Inquirer quickly adopted his technology, ushering a new era of information dissemination. But here comes the tragic incident. In 1867, while overseeing the installation of one of his rotary presses at the Philadelphia Public Ledger newspaper, Bullock noticed a misalignment in the machinery. Ever the hands-on inventor, he decided to personally adjust the equipment. During the process, his right leg became entangled in the moving components of the press. The injury was catastrophic. Bullock's leg was crushed when he tried to kick a driving belt onto a pulley, and gangrene soon set in. Exasperated by the lack of advanced medical treatment available at the time, in an effort to save his life, doctors performed an amputation, but Bullock succumbed to complications shortly after the procedure on April the 12th, 1867. Analysis of the risks and the occupational hazards of innovation. Inventors like Bullock were the pioneers of their age, often working without the safety protocols or protective measures we take for granted today. Machines were designed for efficiency and productivity, with little thought given to operator safety. Bullock's press was no exception. Its high-speed mechanisms, while revolutionary, posed significant risks to anyone working near them, causing a type of revolutionary damage. This lack of safety standards was not unique to Bullock's invention. During the Industrial Revolution, factory machinery frequently caused injuries and deaths. The tragedy of Bullock's accident underscores the broader societal costs of technological progress during this period. Bullock's death served as a cautionary tale, as always when it comes to innovators' deaths, about the balance between innovation and safety. His story highlights the importance of thorough safety testing and the need for inventors to approach their creations with humility and a keen eye. Now, while his press was undoubtedly a success, the cost of his development serves as a reminder that no invention is worth the inventor's life. But what of the legacy of William Bullock? Well, despite his tragic death, Bullock's contributions to the printing industry remain monumental, to say the least. His rotary press accelerated the spread of information, contributing to the democratization of knowledge and the rise of mass communication. Newspapers became affordable and widely available, enabling ordinary people to engage with current events, literature, and culture. Bullock's innovation also inspired future innovations in printing, from offset presses to digital printing technologies. His legacy is a testament to the transformative power of engineering and creativity, even as it serves as a sobering reminder of the costs associated with progress. Now, Bullock's death also highlights the need for rigorous safety standards in industrial design, a lesson that resonates today. Modern engineering places a heavy emphasis on ensuring that machines are safe to operate, with emergency shutoffs, protective barriers, and extensive testing. These measures have been shaped by the hard-learned lessons of inventors like Bullock. And of course, William Bullock's story is one of brilliant innovation and tragedy. His rotary printing press transformed the world of publishing. Yet his untimely death serves as a reminder of the risks faced by those who push the boundaries of what's possible. And that goes for every single one of our inventors tonight, in this episode. What strikes me from a positive perspective for all these inventors is the amazing passion for their work and their unending determination to see it come to fruition and be successful. All it takes is an iota of that passion to move mountains. But it is, of course, a shame that with that passion, in these cases, there was an incredible price to pay. Now, my living legends, I hope you enjoyed this episode. It is something different, as I mentioned at the intro. If you like these episodes or more suggestions on these kinds of episodes, please let me know. I am all ears. Send me your feedback with comments in my Patreon or comments wherever you can pop them, and I'll read them and take them on board. I had a blast covering this topic, and I think I'll continue to cover these topics in the future. On top of this, I'm also interested in modern day stories and modern day topics, covering content like the Huck Tour Lady and the scandal surrounding her, or even drama content like Johnny Somali, because I personally find them interesting on the consequences and also how these people even come into the limelight. And don't worry, I'm not pivoting from my usual horror stories, not at all. But I will sprinkle these in as seasoning to the already existing story set. Just keen to have your feedback, yay or nay, What are your thoughts? Now, legends, I want to thank my Patreon supporters. But before I do, if you want to be a Patreon supporter, like these legends that I'm going to be sharing with you shortly, visit my Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/SFGT, where you can support me directly, where all Earl Grey forces and above get early access by a whole week to my episodes, and they get higher quality episodes, 320 kilobytes, opposed to the usual 192. So I'm going to be heard with your lovely ears even crisper. So if that's something that you would like, and you want to support a podcast that remasters old audio, shares stories with everyone and anyone around the world, and likes the idea of having a podcast with no ads ever, well, then I'm your guy. And thank you in advance for considering. Now, onto my legends, my Patreon supporters. I want to thank my Ode Night T Titan, the mythical, who I'm certain the Aztecs wrote about as being a deity of generosity and unending kindness. I swear I've heard it somewhere in the wind that the amazing, the illustrious Matt O'Star, the deity of endless support, is scribed into the Aztec stones out there. Up there with Quetzalcoatl, I'm certain, my friend. Dudio, thank you for your amazing support. And firstly, I want to say Merry, Marvelous Christmas to you, Matto. Because of you, this podcast is really what it is. And supporters like you make this podcast what it is. This year, I've been able to do leaps and bounds with technology. I've been able to create my voice in a female voice. I've been able to modulate and clear up noise and sound, repair and remaster audio that is basically almost like 100 years old plus. And I've also been able to test my skills and knowledge and grow as a podcaster, all thanks to you and legends like you. But your tier of support has really put the jet thrusters underneath this podcast, and it really would not be the same podcast without your support. And I don't mean that lightly. Access to tools would just not be an option. I don't run adverts on my podcast. So your immense support covers pretty much everything per month. And I've got some left over to actually dabble with and put that A-plus stamp. So Matt O'Star, because of you, mate, I've been able to broaden the horizons and do a lot more than I thought I could do in this year. So thank you so much from me to you for supporting me at this amazing, amazing tier. I'm so lucky to know you and so lucky to call you as my friend. Thank you so much, Matt O'Star. I hope you have a fantastic Christmas and a brilliant week. Much love to you, mate. You're one hell of an amazing friend. Thank you, man. And my white tea warlords, and my three brilliant white tea warlords. I can never, ever say enough about these legends. My first of three white tea warlords, Lesasaurus Rex, the man that eats iron and crap steel, who is such a magnificent human specimen that when he walks into the gym, they ask him for the subscription costs to attend there. This is a man that has supported me for so, so long. And just like Matt O'Star, an original and also a godsend of a human being, thank you so much for being my unwavering stalwart, the cornerstone of this podcast, Leza. Jokes aside, because I always want to crack a silly joke or goofy joke, your support has helped so much out when it covers administrative costs, costs for actually paying for plugins so I can actually, you know, remaster content, and overhead costs to keep the website running. Thanks to you, I don't have to worry about any of that jazz. It really takes a weight off my shoulders, and I can never spruik it enough how grateful I really, really, really am. Thank you so much, Lesnar. You are a superstar. Merry Christmas, and I hope you're having a break. Otherwise, have yourself a fantastic week. Thank you immensely, my friend. You're fantastic. And my next white tea warlord, Joseph Schroeder, a superstar in his own right, my zombie-loving friend, I wish you the best Merry Christmas as well and a wonderful week. I've almost fixed up my zombie-esque Sherlock Holmes story. I'm just doing a lot of tweaks because sometimes it can go a bit sideways and you can lose track of the plot, but I cannot wait to showcase it. It'll definitely be in January, but rest assured, my gift to you, legend, is this horrific Sherlock Holmes. I'm still trying to figure out the direction that I want to go through as I move from chapter to chapter, but I'll get there. So Joseph, big shout out to the family. Have a wonderful break. I hope you're having a break, at least. And thank you for being my friend and supporting me in the way you do. Thank you so much, mate. You're a legend. And my final white tea warlord, Maya, you superstar. The queen of cats. The amazing supporter that has a great sense of humor and cheeky wit. I'm so lucky to have your support. And thank you for always giving me good ideas when it comes to stories. Even if it's based on the fact that one of my stories I put forward could have a potential spin-off, or the ending could be tweaked. I'm of course referring to the story about the forest being eaten alive and corrupted by evil's forces. But thanks to you, Maya, I always get to think creatively. Thank you immensely. Have a fantastic Christmas or break. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Maya. You are brilliant. And of course, I want to thank my superstars as well. The peeps who put a pep in my step. My Earl Grey enforcers. I am so lucky to have Chad Warren, Peter Effioli, Just Heather, Juicebox Andy, Divided by Zero, Paige Kramer, Jane Gumnick, Seductive Smiles, Michael Krupp, Joseph Schroeder, Jessica Garcia, and Sangeetha Sagar. And also, Dave Baxter. Wonderful to have your support, you legend. And thank you all, my amazing Patreon supporters. Just to reiterate, if you want to support what I do, visit www.patreon.com/SFGT. Have yourself a fantastically brilliant Christmas, a wonderful break, and a happy new year. And rest assured, there will be more stories on the way next week. As always, till next we meet.
Night whispers secrets untold. Ghostly tales centuries old. In the shadows, mysteries unfold. Listeners gather brave and bold. Stories, fables, ghostly tales. Wide with fear. Tales of the unseen draw near. Blurring lines between what's clear.
Joseph and Maya, have a great week.